United States Court of International Trade is now in session. The Honorable Gary S. Katzmann presiding before court number 22-00149. Captain Demir versus the United States et al. Will the attorneys please state their names for the record, starting with the plaintiff?
Andrew Schutz for plaintiff Captain Demir from Grand Front of Ontario.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Stephen Cassini from the United States Department of Justice, and I represent the United States.
My name is Mitch Purdy, and here on behalf of the Department of Commerce.
I'm Maureen Thorson of Wiley Ryan, here today on behalf of defendant interveners, the Rebar Trade Action Coalition, and its individual members.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome. The parties have responded to the oral argument questions that was submitted to you, filed on April 22nd, April 5th, 2024. The court also issued a couple of supplemental questions on April 22nd, not seeking written responses at that time, but just to inform the parties as to some of the court's thinking after review of the responses to the oral argument questions. The counsel knows that each side will get to have 20 minutes for their presentations. The hope is that the parties will use their time to respond to the answers that have been submitted by counsel. You have the opportunity within the 20 minutes if you want to make a brief statement. As is my custom, I will give the parties an opportunity to file a post-argument submission of not more than 1,250 words. That will be due on May 1st, 2024. So without any further ado, why don't we hear from the plaintiff's counsel.
Good morning. Again, Andrew Schutz for Captain Demir. I'm not going to do an opening statement. I'm just going to go right into the
sure. The
responses. Is there a particular order that you would like me to?
No, why don't you do what you're most comfortable with?
Okay, that's fine. I think what I'll do, sometimes they kind of bleed together a little bit. So I think what I'll do is I'll just, I guess kind of generally for the issue of the stay, I mean, I don't really have much more to say than what I've already put in our response to an argument or in response to the oral argument questions. The only thing that I would say in response to the government's oral argument questions on that issue is that they say that there's different issues or different arguments or different facts, they haven't really identified precisely what those were. I think everyone kind of agrees that the briefs and the arguments that were made during the original proceeding and before this court are identical, and that the decision for the Federal Circuit really is going to dictate what happens in this case, and at the very least, it's going to require a remand here. So I think at this point it does make the most sense to stay at the very least that issue. And I think everyone also agreed that the tax exemption is ripe for decision if Your Honor wanted to make a decision now. But like we mentioned in our briefs or in our responses to oral arguments, I think just for efficiency purposes, it might be better to stay that decision. So we're dealing, if Your Honor remands it, so we're dealing with one remand for all issues instead of multiple remands, multiple comments.
What is your understanding regarding the status of the appeal in the Federal Circuit?
So the defendant interveners have filed their direct brief. Our response briefs are due in a couple weeks. And I don't recall when the reply brief sometime after that. And so I would suspect there'd be an oral argument probably in the fall. Early fall, maybe, more or less. Okay. Turning to the questions, the government's responses to, I'm going to start with, I think, three, arguing about the exemption and that it was just, I guess just exhaustion in general. So I think I would just start with, Your Honor, the Court of International Trade enjoys discretion, a bit of discretion when identifying whether exhaustion applies, and that the parties generally are not required to anticipate issues that have not been raised by a party or an agency before. So just with those two kind of general premises, I'll just go straight to your question was, given the similarity between these two provisions of 1677-5AD, little I and little double I, whether it would be appropriate for exhaustion to apply here. And we, of course, believe that it would not be appropriate for a couple of reasons. One, I would say that when you look at the preliminary decision here, it's extremely sparse. This is the first time this program has been investigated. And when you look at the Commerce's preliminary determination, all they did was identify the different categories in the law and say that those categories rendered it specific because they were limited. So Commerce was really focusing only on this extremely limited language in little I. And I think it's important to remember that when you look at these two statutory provisions, while they both apply to de jure specificity, little double I is not always triggered. Little double I is an exemption to the de jure, basically an exemption to de jure specificity. But there are many instances where little I, Commerce's decision regarding little I would not necessarily trigger double I. So for example, if the law was limited to only a particular industry or only limited to exporters, I think we would agree, I think probably everyone would agree here, that would be an expressly limited statute and that you could not get around or avoid specificity by using double I. So I guess I'm kind of dovetailing a little bit into your question about what made it triggered for the first time here. So when you look at what Commerce did in the prelim, Commerce was only looking at, they basically just said that it's expressly limited to firms that conduct certain kind of foreign transactions. That was basically it. So they're focused on little I, they're focused on that this is just expressly limited. And when we filed our brief on this issue, actually you can kind of see our confusion because we raised two issues. We said one, well, limiting it just to companies that make foreign trade transactions is not, that can't be your universe of a limited transactions or limited group of industries. And then second, we said that, well, if you look at one of these categories, it applies to industry companies that have industry certificates, and the record shows that all manufacturers in Turkey use that. Then you can see when Commerce issues their final decision, first they say, well, we didn't base our specificity finding on the fact that it was limited to foreign transactions. We were limiting it to the specific categories. And then they say for the first time that the government of Turkey, and I'm just going to quote here because I think it's helpful. It said the GOT did not further define the parameters under which it defines industrial establishments or identify and explain the criteria under which it grants or denies industrial registry certificates. So now for the first time, Commerce is suggesting that the parameters or the criteria of the law are not particularly clear. I mean, it's almost saying, addressing a little double I argument without actually citing it. And not only that, but they, when they say that there aren't any parameters for the definition of industrial establishments, I think as we showed in our brief, that was actually incorrect, that the government of Turkey in their new subsidy allegation response at Exhibit 2 provided a law that actually identifies what an industrial establishment is. So that is why we said in our response to oral argument questions that this double I was triggered for the first time, because one, you have a reference, Commerce's reference to these different parameters and criteria. Two, you have an error in fact. And three, you just have the nature of how sparse their preliminary determination was. And the fact, I guess just the fact generally, that little double I is not always triggered. So it's not like every time you make a de jure specificity argument that you're automatically bringing up double I. There are lots of circumstances where only I, a little I would apply.
And what is your best case to support the analysis you just provided regarding the question, the supplemental question relating to triggering?
Yeah, I guess the best
judicial case.
Best judicial case. You know, I did mention in my responses the BGH case, which was just issued, or one of the decisions that was just issued.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that case is helpful because it provides a little bit more explanation as to the differences between I and little I, and goes into some of the background from the FAA, which, and I certainly acknowledge that we did not go into that background in our brief. But if Your Honor wanted to look at some of the background and what little I, little double I means, that's certainly something we can address in our supplemental brief. But I think one thing in particular that's important is that you have the FAA says in particular that a subsidy is not de jure specific just because it covers fewer than all companies. And because of that, we would expect, certainly in the preliminary determination for a program that's never ever been investigated, for Commerce to provide a lot more explanation as to what exactly they're thinking and why this program was de jure specific.
The government, in its response to the oral argument questions, says, as you know, that determining whether a program incorporates objective criteria or conditions is distinct from the analysis regarding whether a program is expressly limited to certain enterprises or industries under 19 U.S.C. 1677-5AD.
Yeah.
It's a small I, and it cites the case that you reference now as well, and as you referenced before, the BGH case.
Right.
What is your response?
I certainly agree that it's there are different issues to consider, and I also would agree that if for Commerce to, that a remand would be required for Commerce to address these issues because they were not addressed below. My position is, and looking at the standard of exhaustion, is whether or not it was reasonable that we raised this issue for the first time in our briefs before the court. And I think that, and this kind of goes to your question about, like, what is the standard that you should apply in looking at this exhaustion, and I think that the court is required to strike a balance. You have to strike a balance. You have to strike a balance between Commerce being on notice and then whether the parties need to anticipate what types of arguments the parties need to anticipate. And there's certainly a spectrum of situations that apply there. And I think that when you look at and you're trying to strike a balance, you need to look at how detailed was the preliminary determination, how different is the argument that's being raised now compared to what was raised below, and does it rely on different facts? And I think here you have, as I already mentioned about the prelim, I think that was sparse. I think that you have new things coming up for the first time in the final determination, particularly this issue about Commerce being concerned about the different parameters and criteria, and also making the factual error about the definition of industrial establishments. But I think, like, ultimately, the facts that we're not really relying on different facts at the end of the day between the a little I argument and a two argument. So it's not like a bunch of other cases that have been cited. There were entirely new facts that were brought up for the first time that could not have been that could have been brought up before, and I don't think that is the situation that applies here.
You have, by the way, about 6.5 minutes. So
yeah,
I just want to mention that.
I kind of jumped around, so I just wanted to see if there was any other issues to address. There was a reference in the defendant intervener's responses about NIR and whether NIR did or did not use this program and how that might be relevant.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that I would say to that is I think it's need to look at what was actually said in the responses. What the response said was that NIR did not use the program and that they had a couple of spot transactions where they paid the taxes. Now, that's not the same thing as saying that NIR was not exempt from paying the taxes on these transactions. I mean, it's certainly, and now we're into hypothetical land because this was not addressed or questioned during the course of the review, but there's certainly a hypothetical situation where a company would not decide to use the exemption, a particular tax exemption, if the amounts were so little that it was not worth doing. Like, for example, for my own case, in my own taxes, sometimes I don't claim exemptions on or get the benefit of maybe donations because my donations are not even worth the effort to kind of go through the process. So I would not rely on that as a basis to determine whether or not the program is not lit or whether the program is limited or not. And then the last one, I guess the last issue I would address is, defendant intervenors, the question that you raised about whether it's relevant how Captan used the program.
Mm-hmm.
I think that generally it could be helpful to understand how the criteria is implemented or how the case is or the program is implemented, but certainly how Captan Demir used the program is not determinative of whether the program is de jure specific or not. De jure specificity relies solely on the law, and the criteria outlined in the law. And if you're starting to get into the realm that the law is not applied as written, then that starts to get more into a de facto subsidy, de facto specificity analysis, which is not what we have here. Certainly not what the department relied on. I think I've hit all my all the points I wanted to raise, unless Your Honor has any questions.
I do have a question regarding Captan 3.
Oh, sure.
And wondering what your thoughts are regarding Captan 3. And my understanding is that you're not counsel.
I'm not,
Captan 3.
Yeah, so I'm somewhat limited. I didn't represent Captan in that review,
mm-hmm.
And I'm not representing them in that appeal.
Mm-hmm.
So in response to Your Honor's questions, I did look at the briefs, but I did not go through the whole record of that review to have a real understanding. So I would almost I'll wait for your question.
Right. Well, you know, basically, if the court stays proceedings in this case, would the pending motion for judgment on the agency record and Captan 3 remain ripe for decision?
Based on my understanding, I think it would still.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the attribution of subsidy issue is not in Captan 3.
Mm-hmm.
So that we don't have to worry about that. The benchmark issue is different than the one that could potentially be raised here. And it sounds like, based on my review, that the tax issue is basically the same. So I think you can make a decision in that case, and then we can deal with, you know, if you rule a particular way in that case, we can, you know, determine at the appropriate time the impact on this case.
Anything further, counsel?
I think that's it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Tassini?
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'll begin with the court's additional questions from the 22nd of April. We agree that it's possible, but not guaranteed, that Captan 1 will result in a precedential opinion. So turning to the stay issue, I did an unscientific survey of the last 5 Federal Circuit published opinions, which came out in the last 5 months, and it took between 18 months and over 2 years between notice of appeal and decision by the court. During that same time, the Federal Circuit also dismissed 6 appeals. So basically, there's a less than 50% chance, very likely, of getting a precedential opinion. And the two opinions that took the shortest amount of time to issue were in customs protest cases. So the trade cases took longer. So we're looking at about 2 years, probably, from notice of appeal to decision, you know, plus 45 days for a mandate. That leads to the risk of cases being stacked up behind an appeal, memories fade, agency personnel leave. It makes the possibility of a remand more difficult for everybody. And that's why we believe that a stay is unwarranted. And the second reason is, you know, as we noted in our brief, on remand in Captan 1, Commerce did a deep dive into the record that it didn't do in this case and hadn't done before in Captain 1, and it looked at a number of pieces of record evidence, and including NERS financial statements and NERS tax returns. Well, here we're going to have different evidence on the record. So even if Commerce applies the same analysis, we can't really speculate as to what the outcome would be if the court were to remand. We can speculate, but we don't, at least.
Right.
The Department of Justice does not like to speculate as to the outcome of administrative proceedings. Turning to the...
And by the way, as to the point that Mr. Schutz considered, at least, you know, hypothetically, and that is staying part of, the analysis, the decision here, but reaching the tax exemption issue.
That's probably the worst of the three options in our view, because it leads to the possibility of two remands, the first one being kind of an interlocutory remand that creates some sort of decision that remains in limbo until the court then looks at the cross-ownership issue. So we would, our first choice is no stay in the court, reach a decision on the merits and let the chips fall where they may on a possible remand. Our second choice would be a stay of everything, but a partial stay does not comport with this court's Rule 1 in our view. Turning to the exhaustion issue, which was question 3 posed to the plaintiff, I was struck by how counsel candidly admitted that D2 was an exemption. And the whole point of an exemption is the party that wants an exemption, as counsel noted, has the burden of establishing that exemption. It's a standalone exemption that from day one, it was there in the statute, and plaintiff knew that it had to make certain showings to establish that exemption. Second, plaintiff also appeared to admit that there was really no change in Commerce's factual findings between the preliminary and final determination. So if you look at the PDM at page 11 and compare it to the final decision memo at pages 19 and 20, Commerce looked at the same 5 facts and reached the same decision. And if you also look at the final decision memo, nowhere does the agency cite D2. So I mean, under Roan-Poulenc, this is a very clear exhaustion issue. In our view, simple looking at another angle of the same issue is not sufficient to exhaust. Yes, they're looking at specificity from a different angle, from a different viewpoint, but that doesn't matter. In a dumping case, you could look at normal value from two different viewpoints, and there would still be a failure to exhaust.
Counsel appears to suggest that the government really did not provide an adequate clue as to its the potential for deciding under a different subsection.
It's not the government's burden to create a record. It's the party's burden to create a record. And so if you go back to plaintiff's case brief before the agency at pages 23 and 24, there were two paragraphs that relied only upon D1 and provided scant information. As the courts have repeatedly held, it's not the administrative agency's job to root through the record to find evidence that might support an argument that was never made. I'd like to turn to the BGH case for a moment.
obviously the agency never had an opportunity to address this interplay between D1 and D2. And if the court were to find that there was no failure to exhaust despite the minimal attempt at showing even a D1 issue in their case brief, then the court would have to remand to the agency to make a decision. And finally, turning to the court's additional question number 2, the court asked whether Commerce had waived its right to respond to Captain's D1 argument. That was never raised by any party in their brief, and so that was what we were referring to. And we believe that the agency's determination fully addresses the D1 arguments, and we also fully we believe that that issue has been briefed and is ripe for decision on the merits.
With respect to the BGH case, what is the status of that? Has it been taken up to the Federal Circuit, or what's happening?
Well, Commerce issued remand results, and the government filed its response to remand comments about 2 weeks ago. I believe that the petitioners were the one who objected to the remand results. So I believe that the agency found it favorable to respond to it.
Okay.
But then again, also BGH is not an exhaustion case.
Mm-hmm.
So presumably BGH did not fail to exhaust at the administrative stage. For these reasons, we respectfully request that the court deny the request for stay and sustain the final results. Thank you.
Do you have any thoughts on Capton 3?
We believe that a stay of Capton 2 would not derail a decision on the merits of Capton 3. The cross-ownership issue is not present in that case, and as counsel noted, those sorts of decisions are generally, when private parties make a decision on what to challenge, it's based on the private party's own economic interests, and if there wasn't enough scrap sold to make it worthwhile, there's no real reason to bring a case, for that matter. On the other issues, there are very different factual issues raised, so we don't see any roadblock to a decision on Captain 3.
Thank you, counsel. You know you have more than 10 minutes.
Thank you. I will yield that time to the court.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Maureen Thorson from Wiley Ryan for Rebar yes. Trade Action Coalition again.
You're accumulating guest reward points on Amtrak.
Honestly, on Delta.
Delta.
Because I live in Maine, actually. So no trains for me. RTAC agrees with the plaintiff that this case should be stayed in full. Although the records underlying Capton 1 at the Federal Circuit in this litigation are not completely identical, both cases raise substantively similar questions as to Commerce's cross-attribution of subsidies. And while this case presents an additional issue regarding the counter-availability of exemptions to Turkey's BIT tax, the shared cross-attribution issue accounts for 90% of Capton's net subsidy margin in this case. The total net subsidy margin was 1.75%. The margin, the specific margin for the cross-attributed program was 1.6%, and the BIT program is only 0.1%. So if Capton ultimately prevails on the shared cross-attribution issue in this case, the subsidy margin for the review will fall to de minimis levels, and there won't be any duties applied to it anyway. So practically speaking, there's no reason in our tax view to go forward with the BIT issue while staying the cross-attribution issue, both issues should be stayed simultaneously. And there's no particular reason to rush a decision on the BIT issue, given Captain's failure to exhaust administrative remedies regarding the BIT program in this case. Commerce clearly found the program de jure specific in its preliminary review results, reasoning that the eligibility for the program is limited to five types of companies, as listed in presidential decrees that were identified in the Government of Turkey's new subsidy allegation questionnaire response, which the agency cited in its preliminary decision memo at 11 and 12. Captain's opposition to this finding of de jure specificity below was brief and sketchy. The company only argued that any industrial establishment in Turkey could obtain an industrial registry certificate placing it within one of the five types of companies eligible for the exemption. Its arguments on appeal go much further, as it claims not just that certificates are available to any industrial establishment, however that is defined, but that all manufacturers in Turkey are required to have these certificates. It also argues that even if BIT exemptions are limited by law to specific groups of companies, the eligibility criteria are impartial and horizontally applied. But there's no reason Kaplan couldn't have made these arguments in his agency case brief in response to Commerce's preliminary treatment of the BIT exemption program as de jure specific. And I'd like to draw the court's attention in this regard to CAPTAN's citation in its pre-argument responses of the BGH Edelstahl litigation. That case arises from the countervailing duty investigation into German fluid steel end blocks. CAPTAN cites the case to support its arguments regarding the BIT exemption program's alleged lack of de jure specificity. But the case is more notable for the light it sheds on Captain's claim that it should not be expected to have made in its case brief the arguments that it brings on appeal. In the fluid end blocks investigation, Commerce preliminarily found that a German subsidy program, which has an incredibly long German name but was abbreviated by everybody as the KAV or CAV program, was de facto specific. An interested party attacked that finding in its case brief, and in the final results, Commerce switched gears, continuing to find the program specific, but on a de jure basis instead of a de facto basis. The party appealed the de jure finding, and no one appears to have argued that it failed to exhaust by not anticipating the switch in its case brief. But that's not the case we have here. Here, Commerce preliminarily found that the BIT exemption was de jure specific, Captain argued against that finding in its case brief, and Commerce continued to find the program de jure specific, explaining why it found Captain's arguments unconvincing. The agency did not move the goalposts, as could have been said to have happened in the fluid end blocks case. Instead, Captain failed to make certain arguments that were available to it in response to Commerce's preliminary finding. Its failure to exhaust is clear, and there's no sound basis to excuse it. And now I'd like to turn to the court's supplemental questions. In its case brief, Captain argued that industrial registry certificates were available to any industrial establishment and thus too widely available to support the conclusion that BIT exemptions were specific. But in making this argument, Captain did not point to any definition of an industrial establishment and did not claim to possess an industrial registry certificate itself. It also conceded that its shipbuilding affiliate, NUR, had foreign exchange transactions on which it paid the BIT tax. Accordingly, it's not so much that NUR should serve as a proxy for the entire Turkish industrial sector, as that NUR's payment of the BIT tax undermines Captain's argument that industrial registry certificates, and therefore the associated exemption from the BIT tax, were widely available. After all, if Captain's claims are correct, why would NUR be paying BIT taxes instead of applying for a certificate and then just being exempted? And Mr. Schutz says, he said, well, you know, I don't claim every exemption I could possibly claim on my taxes. Sometimes it's very hard to do those kinds of things, or just, you know, the juice isn't worth the squeeze. But Captain itself, you know,
That's a great phrase.
Yes.
Yeah.
The juice isn't worth the squeeze.
It's almost in the same category as whack-a-mole.
Yes.
Which Mr. Pacini has used in other arguments. Yeah.
But I'll say that in Captain's new subsidy questionnaire response, where they talked about their own eligibility for the BIT exemption program through being a member of an exporters association. Commerce asked, well, you know, what did you have to do to show your bank to get these exemptions? And Captain said, well, basically just had to wave our exporters association certificate at them, and then they just automatically gave us the exemption for whatever foreign transactions we had. So it seems a little inconsistent with Captain's own claims regarding how widely available these industrial registry certificates supposedly were, that NERA would not just go ahead and wave its own certificate at the bank if it could get one, if these things were as widely available and easily available and therefore would as easily exempt you from taxes as Captain would have you believe. And then as to the court second supplemental question on Captan 3, I believe, or RTAC believes, that Captan 3 would remain ripe for decision even if you stay this case. A stay could not impact resolution of Captan 3 as to cross-attribution of subsidies because there's no challenge to cross-attribution of subsidies in that case. And while both this appeal and Captan 3 involve the countervailability of the BIT exemption program, the BIT issue here may well be mooted in this litigation due to its minimal margin impact relative to the cross-attribution issue. But in the interview or the review underlying Captan 3, the program-specific margin for the BIT exemption exceeds the 0.5% de minimis threshold in its own right. So there's a difference just in terms of whether the program-specific margin is de minimis or not. And so from my perspective, Captan 3 will remain perfectly ripe for decision even if this case is stayed. And then finally, I just had a couple of notes on things I heard in the presentation from Mr. Schutz and Mr. Ticini. Mr. Ticini, or the Department of Justice, believes that a stay is unwarranted at this time because memories may fade. This is a record case. The record doesn't go bad with time. It stays exactly the same as it always has been. So RTAC continues to support a stay in full. And Mr. Ticini said he wouldn't want to go by halves. He wouldn't want to stay the cross-attribution issue and proceed with the BIT transaction issue, and RTAC agrees with that, especially given the potential mootness of the BIT transaction program absent the cross-attribution issue in this case. And then, let's see, finally, one thing that Mr. Schutz noted in his presentation, he's argued that the preliminary decision that Commerce made on the BIT transaction or BIT exemption program, de jure specificity, was, as he put it, sparse, and that he would expect something more from the agency given that this is the first time that program has been investigated. But it isn't the first time this program has been investigated. It may be the first time that it's come up in Turkey Rebar, in a Turkish Rebar CVD review, but it's been reviewed in other Turkish countervailing duty proceedings and discussed. And we identified a couple of those proceedings at pages 23 and 24 of our response brief. And it also doesn't strike me as sparse in light of the citations in the preliminary decision memo. The Turkish government straightforwardly reported that there are these exemptions to the BIT tax. Here's their 5 exemptions. We are listing them out, identifying them for you, and saying they come from presidential degrees, saying, well, that's a law or a legal pronouncement that specifically identifies 5 types of companies that are exempt from tax legally. Seems to me, for Commerce, to say, great, that's de jure specificity, we're done here. That doesn't seem sparse to me. It just seems very straightforward given the reporting they had in front of them. If you have no further questions for me, Your Honor, I'll cede my time back to the court.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. So, of course, we're all here in the travel to the courthouse, and I'll give counsel, 2 minutes each if there's something else that comes to mind that you would like to address, Mr. Schutz.
Sure, I'll just be brief. I think that when you look at this, put aside the D1, D2 issue, or just put it aside for a second. When you look at what actually happened here, yes, Commerce in their preliminary determination identified the five different categories. In our brief, we explained that, well, when you actually look at one of those categories is companies that have industrial certificates, and every single manufacturer in Turkey has an industrial certificate as stated by the government of Turkey in their response. Then Commerce, for the first time, says, no, we don't think that that's accurate. It was not explained further by the government of Turkey or cited to. And then finally, in our brief, we mention actually Commerce was wrong, and there is information on the record that shows what an industrial, a company that, an industrialist, I think is the phrase they use, or a company that gets an industrial certificate. So just for that alone, that Commerce made an error in their determination is a reasonable basis for a remand in this case. Thanks.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Tassini?
Nothing more for the government. Thank you.
Ms. Thorson, just heard Mr. Schutz's response to your analysis.
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. It will not come to any surprise. Mr. Schutz and I disagree on this. I think if you look at CAPTAN's case brief, you'll find that they did not argue that every manufacturer in Turkey has an industrial registry certificate or is required to have one. What they argued is that any industrial establishment, however we happen to define that, and they didn't enlarge on what the definition might be, could get one, and could get one pretty easily. But that's different, to my mind, than saying you have to have one. Saying you can drive a car and you could get a driver's license if you'd like one, but you can drive a car without one, is different than saying you have to have a driver's license to drive a car. So to me, the argument made in the case brief and the argument raised on appeal are distinct, and Commerce responded to the argument that it was made to them. I did not go digging through the record for other types of things that someone might have argued or evidence that might have supported other claims that were not made to them. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. As mentioned at the outset of the argument, the court will give the parties the opportunity to file post-argument submission of not more than 1,250 words. And that would be due on May 1st, which is a week from today. Our arguments are concluded. I'd like to thank counsel for the enlightening arguments and for your various submissions, and wishing you safe travels till next time. Thank you.
All right. Court stands adjourned.